Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Hi. April the 14th, and this is our clean call for this Tuesday. So first off, are there any announcements? I heard one a little earlier, so maybe we can repeat that for everyone.
Yeah, I know it got sent to the listserv, I think, yesterday or late last week, but Ohio State and B. Grant is sponsoring a speaker today. And Ellen Peters, who works in the psychology department at OSU, but the topic is why we don't believe science. And it gets into some of the behavioral science behind why and how people make decisions. The invitation was mostly to speak on how it addressed issues of climate change. But we've actually had a lot of interest from the public health community because of the history there with tobacco and also the connection with vaccines. Because that the psychology that underpins denial in one camp also transfers to other areas where it's applied. And so we've had, as of right now, there's 675 people signed up to come online, which is substantially more than we anticipated, and it's increased dramatically the last 3 days.
So,
should be a good talk.
When is that today?
It's today at 3:30, and I'll send out the link to the listserv again with the information. You just have to register online, and then it'll be via WebEx.
Okay, excellent. That's 3:30 Eastern?
Yes.
Okay, very good. It's fascinating that there's that much interest in all of this, or even that we have to talk about it, but that's just the way.
The related announcement, kind of an end of an announcement, is the Environmental Literacy Grant Program at NOAA just closed yesterday, and there was a tremendous community response to the offering related to extreme weather and global change, if you will. There's a lot of very interesting projects exploring the, you know, how does education relate to community resilience? It'll be interesting to see what we're able to fund with FY15 dollars. Hopefully, we'll be able to get it processed and out within this fiscal year. That might be a bit of a challenge given the strength of the reply. So one thing for the community to think about is, one, if you were not a partner or a PI or a co-PI or whatnot, and you're interested in this topic, to let the Office of Education know, because you may need your services may be needed for reviewing proposals. The more that come in, the more reviewers that are needed. So just something to think about.
Frank, this is Minda. I'd be really interested in reviewing. I'm curious, how would I go about letting somebody know that my interest?
So Minda, one thing you do is let me know.
Okay.
And I will pass your name along to probably the key person you would want to contact if you don't know her is Carrie McDougall in the Office of Education.
Okay.
That's what I would do.
Okay.
So you're keeping Carrie busy. That's good.
Yeah, but it is very true that there's a role that we in the community can play. It's community review of proposals. As long as we're free and unrestricted, you know, from a conflict of interest perspective. But that's always another helpful thing to be done.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you, Minda.
Yeah.
And others. You never know with the trolling that goes on in this listserv and the listening to the recorded, I speak more widely than I used to.
Frank, has the budget for the next fiscal year already been decided, or is that still pending? So we actually don't know how much money would be allocated to this particular proposal.
We do know how much would be allocated. So you got to remember that the amount of money that's in the budget for this, I believe, is public information. It's around $4 million, but it has to cover the mortgages from past, you know, commitments. And the new starts. So it's you never know. It's hard to calculate exactly what the available money is, but it's something in that order.
Okay, that's good. So any other announcements, or maybe we can move into some sort of topic, and I'm not even quite sure what we want to talk about today.
Well, this is Minda, and actually I had a question I wanted to throw out to folks.
Sure.
So for AGU, since it's coming up soon, myself and Laura Tenenbaum from NASA and Rebecca from ACE, we're going to do a session on getting scientists into the classroom. And we had some good ideas for scientists to come in and speak about that, but I'm wondering if anyone had any ideas for educators who would be at AGU, ideally probably not college, maybe lower, like high school or even younger than that, who would have had experience with this and could come and give a talk.
Hmm. Jason, are you on the line today?
Yes. So you're looking for a teacher that's collaborated with the scientists?
Exactly, yeah, or even somebody who works with educators as sort of a middleman or something like that.
I mean, that's some of the work I do, and we have a few people in the local community here. The only challenge would be usually there's enough in the budget where I go to AGU in December, but I don't really go to any. You're talking about the upcoming meeting.
No, the one in December.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's the one in whatever, Ottawa, wherever it is.
Yeah.
The one in San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean,
the one in San Francisco.
Yeah.
What kind of, what were you looking for as far as information to be shared? Like ways to interact with, to collaborate, create collaborations between school teachers and scientists?
Yes. So I think maybe either examples of success or lessons learned or best practices, any of those kinds of things. I think, you know, one of the things that I've run into quite a bit is folks feeling like, yeah, scientists are great in the classroom, but they come in and push everybody around. So maybe somebody who could come in and talk about really positive ways to engage in that setting or successful ways that folks have done it in the past.
Yeah, it's my position is kind of unique on campus because most centers don't have one person doing outreach, and I'm actually a lot of my work is working with other partners on campus that don't have anybody in outreach, and trying to vet and figure out how to help people on campus listen to what educators want, because they usually tell you what they want in that relationship, but oftentimes there's a barrier, I guess, with jargon or with experience where you have to choose the right person and also know when they make certain requests what they're really asking for. And we have a number of teachers we work with, some just once a year for coming for programs. We have other folks that are actually help teach our workshops. So I might be able to work on that and maybe could see if we could bring an educator. We've never tried to do that before, but bring an educator from our area to see AGU.
Oh, that would be really neat. Jason, what's your last name? Sorry.
Cervenek, C-E-R-V-E-N. C as in cat, E-R.
Oh, C-E-R. Okay, Cervenek.
V as in Victor, E-N-E-C.
Okay, thank you.
Cool. And I'm actually going to send something to the listserv here in a second with the talk for today, so it'll have my email address on there.
Perfect.
Because I know when I was teaching, one of my early disappointments with the university, being a graduate here, is a lot of times university would show up with a program that was kind of canned, and they'd show up and it's kind of like a consultant showing up at a business, and it wasn't quite what you were asking for, and not when you were asking for it, and when you walked out, you kind of scratched your head. So that's kind of been, we've kind of tried to be very deliberate about asking a lot of questions up front to make sure that what we deliver, and it's honestly given us better results and better programs.
So, Jason, have you kind of ever written that up in some way? Because it sounds like it would be very useful for other groups to say, okay, this is the best way to bring scientists, and these are the questions you should be asking, as you just said.
No, it's one of those little gems that I never really, you don't really think it's that valuable of information until somebody else looks for it.
Yes.
No, so I haven't. I should. That would be something good to share. Yeah,
so
not to give you some more work, but it is what we do.
Minda, one of the things that as somebody who works at the interface between the science organization and the education systems, when I counsel how educators can engage in this space, there are a couple of people that are really, really talented that are good that mm-hmm. you might want to think about. Mm-hmm. But even there's a more strategic level of how to work with that. And the clean collection process.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that's really smart about the way that was designed so many years ago was mm-hmm. having the expert scientists and the scientists involved in review camps mm-hmm. gives them a very manageable, high strategic value engagement for a large return on that limited time that they have for this mm-hmm. kind of activity. Mm-hmm. And, Anna Gold knows that space because one of the other things that, besides the review camps, which is coming up very soon, is that they can be part of is the expert science review that they mm-hmm. can do on top of the review camp process. We've had something in the order of 180 expert scientists involved in the clean review process over the years, but not having to try to get into each classroom is just a very high bar kind of proposition.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Low numbers of engagement.
Yeah.
And so looking at those, one of the things they've always pushed me to do and that I've always tried to serve them with is those really high-value strategic engagements that give a very large return for that precious limited
amount of time
that they have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
you
those are
I mean?
The kinds of things that we would definitely want people to come in and talk about. How do you get the biggest bang for your buck and how will you make sure that it's a really good use of people's time?
I will tell you the one story that might be worth bringing into this session is mm-hmm. Richard Alley's work with Jeff Ain Styles on Earth the Operator's Manual.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a huge amount of time for Richard Alley, who's a very busy scientist.
Yeah.
To put into that project. But he did it because he saw the strategic value for his time. And so he was able to pour extra time because the return for that time was really valuable. I think mm-hmm. that's one of the key aspects of all of this is that they want to do it. And they want to do it well. But it's just where do you put that time that is going to be the most high return?
Okay,
it's hard to
great.
Find them sometimes.
Well,
yeah.
And Frank and Minda, that suggests another person. I mean, Jeff would be, who's literally spent his whole career in this interface between scientists and educators.
Yep.
He's got lots of experience, and he's often at AGU anyway.
Yep.
He was there last year, certainly the year before when he an award. So Jeff is another person potentially to bring into this discussion.
Great. And also Susan,
not Richard
Susan
himself,
Sullivan. Both, actually. And Susan Sullivan does a lot of this with series out of, with Wale Devlotti now and the whole series Brewing Boulder. I mean, that's a lot
she'd
of
be another good person.
Yeah.
Terrific.
Absolutely.
Okay. This is great. Thank you.
This is what we could do.
Yeah. I knew if I brought the question, you guys would have lots of good ideas, so I'm glad I did.
There's a growing body of, finally Ohio State's kind of mm-hmm. tapped into some collaborations with the outreach community, but there's actually a whole research body on university engagement and outreach, and a lot of that goes into boundary spanners, is the technical name for it in the literature, and we found out that some of these same problems that we face maybe in the sciences we think are unique to science, a lot of other communities on campus face that same issue of how do you bridge that gap between the public and what the experts understand. And I thought it was very unique to us, and then we had these campus meetings that have started maybe about a year ago as they were trying to increase the outreach on campus. And it came up that there's actually a description for this, and there's a lot of work in different communities on how to engage.
Mm-hmm.
Made you feel at least that a lot of people are working
on this. You're not alone.
Some good ideas, yeah. Because at first you think, where is there any place to turn to? So.
Yes, and anyone else has experience.
Do you have anything you can share with? I mean, because that is how I describe my job. a lot of times. I think that a lot of people who are on this call are sit in that space as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, any articulation of what that is would be most valuable.
Yeah, let me dig up. I have a whole folder of stuff from all our meetings. And there's actually a conference every year they do on this. And some of it, there's little nuggets that are there, right? It doesn't all apply, but there's a fair amount of it that does. And when you see some of the research that's been done, it gives you ideas for what you could try in the sciences if it's done in humanities or something else. So let me see if I can dig that up. And there's one or two professional organizations, and there's a few documents we read when we started the process that were useful. I'll send them out to the circuit.
Why I think that's important in the context of your session is that if you have somebody who is in that boundary space that facilitates the crossing of one world into the other, usually it's a higher value initiative.
Mm-hmm.
I think like Jeff Ainsiles played that role for mm-hmm. Richard Alley.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You need professional help here.
Yeah.
And it's re-envisioning, too. Like, when I started at the center, I thought a lot of my work was to get the science out into the community. And you try to think about what are the most efficient, effective ways to get the most for your dollar. But then I also realized, if you think of the programs the right way, a lot of it actually was feeding back to the institutions. So we had a lot of grad students, a lot of postdocs. Some of them were actively involved in outreach if they had an interest, and some of them weren't because nobody ever asked them to or they didn't know where to start. And so you figure out what's their zone of development. Like, where are they? Where's their comfort level? Can we push them a little bit? And we have folks that would never be videotaped, that were petrified to give a tour, who now go out and speak to high school students for us on their own. And so if you think about it that way, and they were easier to access, like Frank said, time-wise, because they're not a PI. So they got a little bit more time on their schedule. They want to go into teaching. They haven't TA'd on campus yet. So this is kind of a way to get them into the comfort zone where they might do that. So there's actually a real benefit to the institution, not just the outreach work. And then you start to get more for your investment of time.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the exciting things to see, you know, when you have, you know, a whole cadre of people you can turn to do the outreach things, and then you have a lot larger audience you can reach and still deliver services and programs at the level the different audiences want them.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Well, great.
Great.
Well, that was a lot.
Thank you, guys. That was all really very useful to me.
We just added a few things to my to-do list today.
Okay.
Tape this one to my desk.
Well, it sounds high value. It could have some great impact. So I have a question. One of the things that happened 2 weeks ago is that Kirsten Poppleton and Jasna, I think was her name, talked about the Climate Minnesota process, which I think, in fact, if I remember correctly, today is their first day, which is probably why Kirsten's not on the line. But one of the things that happened is that we ended up going over 15 minutes because there was so much interest in all of that. And I'm curious whether anyone here had sort of some follow-up thinking about that. And whether there's some prospect for some of that maybe going to other states and other ways in which we use what they're experimenting with. Maybe not. two weeks ago.
It'll be really interesting to see how that model works.
Uh-huh.
I think the last time I've heard Kristen talk about this, that they were taking a lot of different advancements that different people have made in this space, but they've all made pieces of that, and they're really trying to synthesize all those pieces together into a unified, comprehensive strategy. And I think that's nice to see. You know, the field is pushing hard to kind of knit things together in a more meaningful way.
Yeah,
and that's
so
really cool to hear.
It's in some ways similar to what we were just talking about. There's learning that has occurred as we look at the boundary between scientists and educators. And here's sort of another example where scientists and even politicians and working with the public. And, you know, what have we learned about how to do that better? And I think Joe Levine said it, certainly said this, is this the design for their program seemed like it synthesized a lot of stuff that we've all been kind of experimenting with over the last couple of years, and it seems like they've sort of been listening very carefully, certainly Kristen has, and some really good ideas were certainly put into the design of the program. I know, I can just say for myself, I was quite intrigued with that because there's been some discussion here in Washington State about doing something like that. And certainly listening to that presentation has sort of been motivated. In fact, I'm going to talk with Gene McGregor shortly. Is there some way that we can do this kind of program in Washington State? And, you know, obviously it would be great to have it done in other kinds of states too. As we, you know, we move almost like a new phase of climate education where we're recognizing that it's not just in classrooms, that we're having to find other venues. And quite frankly, we have to tread that line between advocacy and education rather carefully. But I think that work needs to happen.
Although, you know, Scott, one of the things that's been showing up in a lot of these conversations about education is a new form of education is starting to form. And the name that's the closest to what it is, it's not formal, it's not informal, it's not place-based, but it's community education.
Yep.
And that's a, you know, what is that, you know, I don't think we've really defined what that is, but I am definitely seeing that as a new, modality of education.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the audience is different, but still it's in the education space as opposed to it's not advocacy. And there's a philosophical reason why it's not that. It's not classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's the closest name I've got.
Another, I think the program that Will Steiger is doing is really what a 2 or 3 hour kind of, I think it's even the evenings kind of event, so it's very different than a classroom-bound activity. Just from that perspective, never mind who's turning up.
Yeah.
Frank, two questions for you. I don't know if Noah keeps track of any of this. I know there's a professional association, but does anybody know, like state climatologists, how many of them are involved in programs like that? And is there any compilation of data and how those offices are structured or how they're funded? The reason is we've been getting a lot of requests for specific programs that's kind of exceeding demand. So we're trying to, our state legislature will, we have a state climatologist entitled, but there's no funding. And then we start benchmarking. And it's been difficult to figure out how are all these programs structured. And I don't know if anybody's actually done this before, because we know Massachusetts just received funding. And it's a university position like ours with a set aside from the legislature every year. And we envision our position doing a lot of work across the state where right now it's very scattered, some regions not being served. A lot of businesses are wanting information, but if you're not in the right region, it's hard to get anybody to even call up to know who to ask what's going to happen.
So I'll point you to, and if you want me to, I can send it to you, in the U.S. Climate Resilience Toolkit. We built a kind of a find, let me see if I can find it here. It's under expertise. There's find experts. And the reason I'm pointing to that is because it actually, the first thing that loads is the U.S. state climatologists' offices. But there's other structures beyond the state climatologists. There's the regional climate service directors. NOAA has a lot of enterprise. Actually, it's seven of them. And then USDA and Department of Interior, and there's a lot of different areas where that kind of expertise can get brought together. But what there isn't is something that kind of navigates you from, you know, your need to the right level of expertise that's out in the you know, this space across the nation. That's kind of one of the things we're working in the Climate Resilience Toolkit, but it's really a bigger issue. But it's complicated, right, because there's a lot of different actors and players in this space. But it's you know, there's no phone book that will actually help you get from your need to service or support in any coherent way yet. So it's bigger than the climatologist office. But, I mean, having that state-level investment would be vital, but it's bigger than just that. I don't know if that helps you or hurts you.
Well, I think it's what we realized is you almost need another networker, kind of a node in the network that can say, okay, you make the call. Here's what you want. I've distilled it down. Now I know where to point you to.
Yep.
And because it's you're looking at people in one area of expertise, business, nonprofit, that are trying to ask, that are trying to peruse all the professional knowledge, and they just can't. And so
yeah,
it helps to know that we're not the only one asking this question, and we're not trying to field an answer.
No, I think anybody, so what's happening is anybody who is in the climate space is getting pounded. We document this at NOAA often, and we are just getting absolutely inundated by requests for customized information for a purpose, and it far strips our capacity. We didn't get the climate service quite a few years ago, and that was just the NOAA part. Anybody working in this field is who's actually serving a particular audience is really having a hard time keeping up with the requests. And I think, you know, you guys are just another example of that. Anybody, all of us are just getting pounded away. We're not built for this kind of performance. So any capacity being added by any level of the system is going to be very valuable. Maybe that's a better way of answering it.
Thanks.
Sure. But, you know, actually, to be very specific, I think at the National... Well, they just changed their name. They're no longer the National Climatic Data Center. The National Environmental Information Center, I think is the name, NEIC. I can never master the name. But NCDC has a lot of support and coordination with the state climatologists. So they may know, you know, specifically each state, you know, how each state is doing it. Derek Arntz, at NCDC probably would be a very good person to talk to.
Okay. I mean, it was funny, one of our early meetings, you know, state climatologist has a lot of, climatologist in general has a lot of baggage with it for some constituencies. So we were asked the question, is that the title you'd like to continue with this job, or should it be called something else? You know,
what kind
those
of baggage are we talking about?
Yeah.
What's that?
What kind of baggage are we talking about?
Well, Ohio would kind of fall into one of those camps where some people would love to not see a climatologist because not knowing information that doesn't exist. And so that was one of the early questions is this the best title for this, or would there be baggage we'd unload if we got rid of the name? And we said, well, we're not really sure what else you'd call the position because that's kind of what it does.
Right.
Now, you call it like state atmospheric data collector. We're not sure what would be the best title for it. And so,
yeah.
Well, somebody you may also want to talk to is Nolan Duskin, who's a big member of this community through the COCORAS program, and he's the Colorado state climatologist. He's walked this space for many, many years, so he was a former head of the Association for State Climatologists. I can't remember the exact professional group name, but he was the president of whatever that is. So he knows this whole area really, really, really well. So be a good person just to Nolan Duskin. He's the lead for the COCORAS program. It was his brainchild.
Okay, great. Great program, so definitely want to talk to him.
Yeah, he's great. Very collaborative guy. Hopefully that was useful for some other people.
Oh, okay.
Is this just the four of us today?
Talk about while we have the time, or shall we go back to previously scheduled work?
Well, one question for you guys, if I have one, kind of like Minda's, is the situation with West Virginia and the emerging situation with Wyoming and the Next Generation Science Standards. Minda, it would be valuable for me to understand, kind of how West Virginia made modifications still
Yeah.
Are they considered an NGSS state now because they've adapted?
That's a good question. Sorry, I just unmuted myself, so I just want to make sure everyone can still hear me okay.
Oh, we can hear you.
Oh, good. Okay. Technology works. So West Virginia, I think, now is not an NGSS state. So, and they admitted that when they made those changes. And I think as far as ACHIEVE is concerned, they feel similarly, which is a shame. Those changes that they finally ended up making, I'm not sure if people saw in the end what they did, were annoying. But not nearly as bad as the original changes. And so at least that's one positive aspect of it. I've been still communicating with the Science Teacher Association over in West Virginia. And they're sort of in a tricky spot because they were holding off on buying like any new textbooks or implementing any new curriculum or anything until these science standards happened. And so they actually said in the press release that, you know, they have materials that refer to GIS as a new technology. So they're like really, really, really behind. And so I think that they're kind of like, let's just keep moving forward as much as possible. The unfortunate thing about what happened, not only that climate change was messed with, but also the way that they went about doing it is completely ignoring the input of all of the science teachers in the state who had worked a really long time to bring NGSS into the state, and all the work of the scientists, everybody. And they just, you know, there are no teachers or scientists on the Board of Ed there. It's political appointmentship. And they can basically do whatever they want willy-nilly. So now we're continuing to work with them to go to the second stage of this, which is, okay, so what are the materials that are going to be implemented, and can we ensure that they get that they are adopting books and materials that have the science correct? And so that's sort of the next stage. And I'll let you guys know if things pop up again. What pops up next?
Well, partly, I mean, thank you, Minda, for all the work in this. But one of the other things that's interesting, you didn't mention that really, I think there's two pieces of it, right? There's the high school course sequence selection, which is how the a state is going to implement either an adapted or an NGSS adopted, you know, standard set. What are they going to do with the high school course set, which is where the vast majority of the content we've focused on in this community sits. But if you have a physics, chemistry, and biology teacher teaching, you know, advanced Earth systems, they're really not in a position to do this skillfully.
Mm-mm.
It's really far beyond their training and comfort and their expertise. And that's what the vast majority of the school systems in the nation, even at the implementing NGSS, are facing. So professional development or getting into the strategic decisions is really, really critical about which courses they're going to require and who is actually going to be doing the teaching of these standards, independent of the curricular content. It's the actual who's the teacher.
Yeah, and I think that that's obviously a big concern. And I think it's tricky because West Virginia is such a tiny state. And so there's a big question of how can you help support professional development in the state as much as possible. And that might be a matter of trying to see what's going on in their science teacher conferences in the state and that sort of thing to see if you can help support in that way. We're going to try at NCSE to get a couple articles in their newsletter that goes out to the educators to try to orient them towards materials and information that could help sort of bulk up their background. But I agree. I mean, there's sort of a larger fundamental issue of what their training and background is and most likely not going to be very strong in this area.
Jason, given you're you know, very close to this physically, West Virginia and your part of Ohio aren't very different. Is that a true thing for your perspective when you work with teachers in your area?
I think there's a big difference between the urban, rural, and suburban schools. I think in the urban schools, one, we definitely know there are fewer earth sciences teachers. A lot of times it's biology teachers that are tapped. And a lot of, there's a change in Ohio happening because we have a new, we have syllabi that are supposed to be the classes follow. And at the state level, they offered a physical geology class, which is good because you have a lot of advanced classes that are now earth sciences, not just introductory classes that are remedial. The problem has been there are teachers racing to get the PD to know what they're teaching. They feel there's a real struggle to find people that feel qualified or that know where the resources are to teach it well, because we haven't had earth sciences as an integral part of the high school in more than a decade. In the suburban schools, I don't think most teachers would report that they don't have a lot of pressure to teach things that aren't scientifically valid. I think as soon as you go into the rural areas, that really changes because you have fewer teachers. And the principals maybe don't have as much background or can be pressured by members of the board, members of the community. We don't see that in the suburbs so much. So it's really kind of an urban-rural divide on that. And I'd say same thing with evolution. You know, evolution and climate change are the two things that, although I taught in a very well-funded, more affluent district, and even amongst our faculty, there was a vast divide on people's science faculty on how they would teach it and what they would teach. And that was something I didn't expect and really didn't realize till later in my career when I was there. I don't know if it's helpful at all. We have not adopted NextGen, and in the state there's been waffling on a lot of things over the last year because there's been a massive pushback amongst a lot of very vocal suburban parents about the new standards and the testing and the high-stakes stuff for teachers. And unfortunately, Common Core and NGS have kind of gotten wrapped up in all that animosity towards high-stakes accountability systems. So we're not exactly sure where things are going to play out. Our rule has been to try to offer a lot more PD and to be available. So, and our PD is really structured on what we get a lot of calls about and trying to meet the demand of what educators want. But the state discussions on NextGen haven't even come up because they just adopted new state standards for science 3 years ago.
This also reminds me of the some of us in the community were part of the conversation back in February at the White House on climate education, and it focused on educators. And one of the things we focused on was that for climate and energy literacy, it was germane to all educators, not just the science ones, which got very interesting. But if we're having this much trouble with science, that makes our challenge even greater. But it's really the integration across the disciplines that students are engaging in at a year-by-year basis, not just the science part. Because that's where civics and government and business and arts and moral and all that other stuff shows up in this space, which is very much, solidly in there. And there were two of the people who were implementing NGSS from Maryland and Delaware who were part of that conversation. And they were strongly in support of that position, which was quite interesting. But that's just a natural evolution of this topic, right? It's not just a science classroom issue. And if you talk to seasoned teachers who master taught for, over 20 years, they'll say this is how we used to teach before all the testing and it's actually reinforced the discipline isolation from each other, not bringing them together. So it's just an interesting space in education right now to think about, the wider context of these issues relative to the topic we focus on here. So
I would agree with that. One of our programs this summer is looking at argumentation and science, social studies, and language arts. And we've had a bunch of teachers that we've been able to wrap into a program to look at how you create a reasoned argument. And that cuts across all disciplines. And that's maybe one of the most exciting things we've been involved with, because we're going to be field testing a lesson about science and climate in an English class for 11th graders that involves kind of a reasoning process and how you discern a reasoned scientific argument with warrants and evidence and a valid claim from one that's not. And, you know, it transfers to history. It's a fundamental part of the Common Core. And I think in the interest of moving any of those disciplines along, those things that bridge the disciplines are going to be the most valuable. I realized the other night how paradoxical it is. We keep pushing STEM ed. At the same time, you see this kind of active attack on science from a lot of different constituencies that would be the same ones that would say they would want more STEM education, more STEM graduates, and how paradoxical that was. And it didn't hit me till the other night how those two are some of the same people that are really advocating for STEM ed and economic will be the same ones that turn on and attack the process of science.
Really? That's very interesting, Jason.
Yeah.
Just as I watch things in our own legislature, and I guess I'm looking more at the state level, but how you see this, we see this massive push for STEM ed at the state level and even carve-outs and exemptions. And then I look at the comments that are made by some of those same individuals, and it's completely inconsistent. They would attack the scientific process for finding out things they don't want to hear, but they'd be happy to fund people going into those fields because they realize it's a high demand area.
Yeah.
It didn't dawn on me until the other night until I read something in the newspaper, and it just hit me pretty hard. I'm like, wow, there's so much inconsistency there. But maybe it's because we have this talk coming up today that about why do we not believe science? That just has me on this kick the last week of thinking for these, look at these inconsistencies across multiple different political backgrounds. And where science is getting, things are getting carved out not to accept.
Right. Well, you know, but I think it's fair to say that the topics we talk about are they transfer across these disciplines. They're really the ultimate integrator from a rich learning perspective. But within the systems and the reforms and the challenges and all that and the social interface between education and society, it's complicated. But I think a STEM-only approach is not going to work to get us where we want to go. And there are two champions of change, people being highlighted at this event at the White House, and one was a physical education teacher, and she took it as a carbon challenge, like a weight challenge. But she was coming at it because she is a physical education professional, and she went at it that way. And then there was somebody from the social sciences who was also called out, and they did it from their perspective as a professional. So it's an interesting. Once you go wider, I think we may find more inclusion than always only going the science route, because it really depends on the choices of lead teachers in schools, and that lead teacher could be somebody who teaches argumentation and teaches climate effectively through argumentation in the English class or persuasive essay, as opposed to always the earth science teacher. Which don't really, there aren't that many of them out there anyway. So I think, you know, in the 140,000 schools, we may find more people who are leading their schools in this direction from a wider set of disciplines than just the science ones.
So Frank, where that takes certainly me is recognizing that our role in promoting, climate literacy for years, is a much broader one, that we recognize that the issues here are more related to science as sort of a social cultural activity, and it's so pervasive in our culture. That's certainly why the pushback on it, because it doesn't play such an important role in everything that we do, and it's both politics and economics. And it does sound like for us, as part of this network, that we need to be, we've made some strides to this, But we really need to be reaching out to folks who are looking at, as Jason said, argumentation. We know it's part of Common Core, but it's also part of what we need to be promoting too, and using climate as an example. We've reached out certainly to social scientists to find out what they're doing, and I think come away kind of surprised the depth of their thinking on all of this stuff. So it to me, it just says, even in our own efforts, we need to cast a larger net to be effective.
I agree. I completely agree, Scott.
Yeah. Great. More stuff.
Well, it's more stuff, but obviously, it's a healthier community when you broaden it further to its right constituencies. How we do it, obviously, we're all the coalition of the willing and the unfunded out here. Some of us more than others, but I think that it's a broader coalition. And I think that's a better way to think about it. It's the right, level of coalition. But we're actually not there yet. But I think, asking ourselves to consider that, one of the groups of people that care about argumentation and using persuasive information effectively are the librarians in the schools. They care about that deeply as part of librarian science. As do the English teachers. So, I think it's a more inclusive framework. Let's maybe look at it that way.
Well, something I hadn't really thought of so deeply is, we've tended to think of climate change and climate literacy in relationship to NGSS, but what we really haven't focused on, and maybe this is key, is its relationship to Common Core, and, obviously argumentation and some of the other elements of Common Core. Maybe we need to also be in that fight too.
Well, I would even go further than that. I agree. And actually, the NGSS is built with Common Core connections already there, but we haven't really articulated it. Some of us periodically have. But then there's the social studies standards and the geography standards that are really rich in this space as well. One of the things that, we're working on is how to set up the 110 climate education challenge that I sent out a little while ago, that we released at the White House Science Fair. And, we're going to begin to get that rolling, but really that was looking at, we don't know exactly how the challenge is going to work, but it's going to be looking at how do you teach this space, climate and energy space, across grades at, across disciplines at a grade level, as opposed to up through science, up and down. It's across, all the classes that a student takes in a year. How does it work that way? And it's an interesting challenge to explore that. But I think that's, each of those disciplines come under different standards. And I think, looking across where a topic reaches across in a meaningful way, in a coherent way, across a year of study with not just one discipline is a much richer framework. I think it's right for this topic.
Yeah, that's good.
So we're still working on the details of that, but you guys will obviously be very aware of how that comes out. And Jason, I think you're tapping into it. I know Carol, Lewis down in Florida. I know she and the Clio Institute are working on this. I know Kristen Poppleton is working on this as well. She's looking at that interface between science and social studies. So I think there's a lot of members of our community that are already heading in this direction because it's just a natural order of things.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah. I think actually, if I could just add. The other session that I'm involved with at AGU is going to be on barriers to understanding of climate change, and so it's going to tackle some of these ideas as well, bringing in sort of the social sciences and what those barriers are beyond just sort of scientific misunderstandings. But, I mean, you can talk about the science all day, but at a certain point, folks are not going to want to learn about it if it really conflicts with their political or social connections. So we're definitely going to be talking about that at HEU.
Minda, there's some work, and I've lost track of it, but related to a lot of the aversion to climate science actually stemmed in the avoidance of the implications of the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And it relates to what you said, but it's a little different, right? Because, you know, if I really accept this problem, then that means I'm going to have to drive a smart car and all that, and be a vegan and uh-huh. wear Birkenstocks. And
yeah.
that totally is not who I think I am and want to be. And mm-hmm. I've done disservice to that research, but I think you get my point. But there's something in that solution space that you feel you resist the science because you don't want to deal with the implications, or at least what you perceive the implications on the solution are. And,
mm-hmm.
You don't identify with what you think the solution space looks like. But I wish I could find that research. It was really interesting. But I didn't.
Really sort of the emergence of doubt sort of on an individual basis is when you kind of don't the consequence of accepting the science. What you do is you deny the science, because that's the in some ways the easier way to deal with all of this. So it must be wrong. I don't have to do it.
You much do easier if it's wrong.
Level, or you can do that at an individual level. I think it's very, very similar, and the motivation is much the same. It's rational self-interest or irrational self-interest.
Or you could get back down to the climate change communication framing aspect. We have one researcher here who works in extension, but he's working with the faith community, and some of his research involves how it's worded.
Yep.
Determine if the person sees it as being part of their tribal belief system or not part of their tribal belief system. So the wording, he's testing various questions right now that ask the same thing in different mm-hmm. ways, and the way it's framed might decide if the person agrees or disagrees and would want to take action or wouldn't want to take action, and trying to tease out how much of it is, you say it this way, instantly I say this isn't in my tribe, the wall shoots up, and I'm not going to listen anymore and just entrench my, dig my feet in harder.
Exactly.
So it reminds me of, there was,
go ahead, Scott.
But there's another piece to it, which is there's a common simple logic that we use in education, or at least sometimes we use in education, where, from awareness builds understanding, from understanding builds concern, and concern builds action, right? And that logic is, when you're dealing with, students in formal education, you can kind of build through that logic. But when you're dealing with people outside of that space, mm-hmm. You don't have the contact time to deal with it. And so but there's an interesting research by the Ocean Project where you flip a couple of those pieces, where you go from lack of awareness to concern and action really quick. And then it flows back into deeper understanding. But, the logic flips around when you have low contact time with adults. Mm-hmm. And how you go from awareness to just action, actually, really quickly, is interesting to look at. But some of the logics that are out there, don't work yet. And some people have been messing around with different logics on how to do that. I know Doug Myers at the Ocean Project has been messing around with that with the Aquaria community for quite some time. It's an interesting evolution of that. You might want to look at that, Jason.
Mm-hmm.
The short of it is that people get concerned and then they go, well, then what would I do to actually make this better? And if you're not ready as an aquarium docent to answer that question, they get frustrated because
you made
me concerned.
Agree.
And,
now
I want to do something to make it better.
We've had that issue because in our center, that's kind of where our story ended. And we started to realize last spring that's the most common question you get asked in every venue. And so we've been working with extension because they naturally do that part of the story, but they don't talk about the why should you be doing something, which is our part of the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been working with them and just some of our public utilities to be able to share. Well, here, let me give you this handout on something you can do specifically that will reduce your emissions today and will save you money. And or here's a resource you
exactly.
can go to where there's a lot more for your farm that will tell you on how to get renewable energy installed and how to walk through the process of looking through contracts for options. But it's putting together those pieces, you're right.
But the last thing that they looked at was significant impact, right? So if it's not like put a sweater on in the winter and you know raise your thermostat
yeah.
a little bit. It's got to be something consequential. So because you realize very quickly this is bigger than just a couple of LEDs in my house and we're good to go, right?
Yeah.
So but a lot of education people well that's advocacy or that's not me, but it actually turns out that it improves the learner's educational experience when they actually get support for something that they care and they want, and they look to you, Docent in an aquarium, to be the person who's going to help them with that, and they're really not prepared to be that. They see it as not their mission, but it turns out that this is what the audience wants them to do. And they're just, there's worldviews in the education system that are getting flipped around a little bit at this
yeah.
topic space, which is really interesting to look at.
Yeah.
I would agree, because, my background being more formal ed, earth sciences ed, action steps, taking action isn't considered a success step, like something you'd try to measure, versus environmental ed, if you slide over to that.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't get actionable change, then, I would say this program isn't as successful. And it's been trying to make sure that a lot of the educators we deal with are cognizant of that, because I wasn't even. And when we work with K-12
right.
educators, helping them understand, what role they see themselves playing and understanding how these two different, I'd say, camps, historically, the kind of the divide, it's an artificial divide, but maybe informal, formal, because a lot more environmental ed had been informal in Ohio versus earth sciences ed being formal. But that action part of it really hadn't even dawned on K-12 teachers as something that would be valued, and that in some fields of education it would be seen as a model of success.
Mm-hmm. But the other thing, Jason, is you jump over to other disciplines where maybe in the social studies you're exploring policy solutions to solve problems within all levels of government and civic society. And you're not specific, you're looking at how to evaluate social responses and effective responses. And, you're not actually implementing it. And if you want to, you can. But, that's not really in an earth science or system science, even an environmental science course. It's closer to environmental science, but even then you only have so much curricular time. So it's really interesting looking at how these issues, when they jump into education systems, informal, formal, place-based community education, really are pushing our community to understand that advocacy line is actually, it doesn't get triggered as much as it used to, and it's appropriate because it's the audience is asking us to explore how to do this more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting
Good.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Scott,
Thank
do, we,
you,
do
everyone.
We need to call the scene here?
Yeah, it's the top of the hour, and this has been a great discussion, and we'll more next week, potentially. Thank you all for participating. This is just really important stuff. Thank you.
Awesome.
Thanks
for
thank
Scott, one quick question. Thank you all.
Absolutely.
But Scott, do we ever know how many people listen to the recordings? Do we know that information?
I don't think we know how many people do the recording. I can check with Tamara. We certainly know how many people are on the line. She gets a report
yeah.
around that. But whether we
right.
know how many people listen to recordings, that sounds like a Google Analytics kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I just it's just an open question because
yeah,
sometimes there's only four of us today, but I think we're
yeah.
more than four people who are going to be involved in this conversation through the recording, and that's an interesting. I hear a
yeah.
lot of trolls are out there, and they value it actually. No, I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean it is that they generate a lot of value out of this. They just can't get to this time.
Oh,
yeah.
Positive trolls.
Yeah, the positive trolls. Them. I don't mean they're trolling us in a negative way. They're just they're coming in. They call themselves in. They've introduced themselves to me because I know your voice. And I'm like, how do you? Right. Oh, I see how. That's interesting. But it's a meaningful, positive experience. But they just, you know, for whatever reason, they aren't able to participate in a vocal way, either synchronously or asynchronously.
Yeah.
So, you know, interesting stuff.
Since all this stuff is ultimately coming through CERC, I'm just wondering whether Sean Fox can give actually has those numbers when somebody triggers a recording. He probably does, as I think about it. So I'll check with him and say, okay, can we actually get some numbers on all that? So that would be very helpful to get a little sense of the impact of making these recordings. And definitely we need to come back to these topics again. Really, really important. Good.
Good.
Well, thanks to everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Very good.
Yeah. Bye.
Take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.